The armed group's modus operandi is really conducive to this kind of displacement. For me, it's really spreading the terror among the communities and making sure that they cannot have a single day where they feel comfortable.
That's the deputy head of the UN Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, outlining just one of the major challenges civilians face there, that's stoking fear and anger in equal measure. Well, welcome to this latest edition of our bi-monthly UN and Africa podcast from UN News. I'm Matt Wells. We'll have more from Najat Rochdi in a moment, but first we'll go to Sudan, where some of the poorest people eking out a living there are rural women farmers. Thanks to a new microfinancing project supported by the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, some women are generating new income, providing jobs and a brighter future for their own families and communities. Based on a group lending principle, the Absumi model helps minimise the risk of any individual ending up in debt and unable to pay off their loan. Jean McFarlane has the full story of how women are finding a way out of poverty and empowering themselves at the same time.
Aisha Abdallah is farming hibiscus, the main ingredient in many fruit teas, which is in high demand both here in Sudan and abroad. But just a few years ago, Aisha, like most rural women, was mainly a subsistence farmer, surviving off the various crops she grew in her home garden. With an irregular income, she had no collateral to get a loan from the bank to start a business. Aisha's life changed when a microfinance project began in her village, and she took out a series of small loans to buy hibiscus seeds, which she thought could become a profitable business.
The loans have helped us do our own farming, so we no longer have to work on other people's farms, where they pay the minimum wage.
Aisha is one of nearly 30,000 women in Sudan benefiting from the microfinance scheme, which started in 2011. It's helping to transform women from subsistence farmers to entrepreneurs. It's a radical step in a country where banks rarely venture into rural areas and few people have bank accounts. Called Absumi, the scheme was set up by the Agricultural Bank of Sudan and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, with support from the Central Bank of Sudan, and is aimed mainly at women.
Here's gender officer Atika Marouf.
Absumi focuses on women because it is much harder for women to access finance than it is for men. Also, women are good at repaying loans on time, and they reinvest the money they make for the good of the family.
Rural women are the poorest of the poor in Sudan and face many challenges. Few have access to education and they often have little say in the running of their families or communities. But many are finding a voice through village-level savings and credit groups. A cornerstone of the Absumi scheme, there are now more than 2,000 in Sudan. Group members can apply for loans of between $150 and $1,200. If anyone defaults on a repayment, other group members must repay for them or lose access to future loans. So far, almost 100% have been repaid. A condition of receiving loans is that members make monthly savings.
Here's credit officer Rehab Ahaj Mohamed Noor.
Savings are used as collateral for the loans and instill a culture of savings within the group and the wider community. They help the community to develop and grow because they can use the savings to finance their own projects.
Busaina Ahmed Ibrahim, a farmer and mother of five, has taken out six absumi. So far, almost 100% have been repaid. A condition of receiving loans is that members make monthly savings.
Savings are used as collateral for the loans and instill a culture of savings within the group and the wider community. They help the community to develop and grow because they can use the savings to finance their own projects.
Busaina Ahmed Ibrahim, a farmer and mother of five, has taken out six Absumi loans in as many years, each one for a greater amount than the last. Her sesame farm is now five times bigger, and her production per acre has also increased. For the first time in her life, she has an income. It has enabled her to build a kitchen and an extra room for her house and pay for her children's school fees.
I now know how to save money and how to budget. I take part in decision-making at home, and I now have confidence in myself.
Aisha has also grown in confidence as a result of Absumi. She now not only farms hibiscus, but sells it at her own market stall and directly to local merchants. And she's learned to negotiate the best possible deal. While her earnings have increased substantially, she says the changes Absumi has brought are more than just financial.
In the past, women didn't take part in things like we do today. Previously, even if we went to a village meeting, we sat separately and didn't understand what was going on. Now we've become very aware of what's happening, and we all sit together, women and men, to sort out our problems.
In coming years, hundreds of thousands more women will have the opportunity to grow their businesses and take their place beside men. By 2025, the aim is for Absumi loans to reach 1 million rural women and their families, giving many more women like Aisha opportunities they would never have had before.
That report from the Sudanese countryside by Jean McFarlane on how a modest strategic investment can reap big rewards for women and their families. To the Central African Republic now, where one of the UN's most passionate and committed senior officials on the continent wears multiple hats as both the humanitarian and development coordinator and shouldering the responsibility of being the number two at the stabilisation mission there, MINUSCA. Former Moroccan government minister Najat Rochdi is working tirelessly on many fronts to try and ensure civilians caught in the crossfire between rival armed groups and discriminated against along ethno-religious lines are able to survive in an increasingly hostile and lawless environment. She's also hugely concerned about the deaths of aid workers and how peacekeepers can protect all concerned from violence and displacement. Ms. Rochdi came into our podcast studio here in New York and spoke to UN News' Liz Scafidi.
2017 has been really a deadly year for the humanitarian, where sadly we lost 14 humanitarian. And I have to say that unfortunately 2018 had a very bad start with the killing of the 6 humanitarian in Makunda. So the 3 mitigation measures, the first one is really to strengthen the civil-military coordination mechanism and the units. It's really getting much better now, which is helping in the prevention, but also in making sure that the intel is shared with the humanitarian. The second thing is to try to group NGOs and UN agencies in common premises so we can really strengthen the security around the compound, which is easier than if you have offices and bases everywhere. And the third one, in places where the insecurity is really very high, we agreed to set up hubs in different areas where it's easier and to fly in and fly out. Because obviously we just don't want to give up on the population and we still need to deliver humanitarian assistance, but not at the cost of the lives of humanitarians.
Have you seen any results yet?
Yes, we started already doing that last September. And for example, in an area in the east called Bangassou, where we had no NGO left there because of the level of violence, we have been still able to deliver food assistance, but also to provide health services and health assistance through those search. Increasing the funding is absolutely critical for us, not only to deliver assistance, but also to make sure we are not losing more aid workers.
The number of internally displaced people has increased by an enormous 80% in the past year, while refugees in neighboring countries has risen by 20%. Can you speak a little about that?
It's a kind of paradox. We have areas which are really stable now, mainly in the west and in the center. There is still a very high level of violence and conflict in the east. And because there is a kind of stability and a kind of assistance which is more diverse than elsewhere, some of the people in the east are really going to the west and sometimes to the far north. And of course, upsurge of violence in some areas which used to be very stable. What happened in December in Pawa, for example, led to the displacement of 70,000 people. That's a huge number. when you know that the city itself used to have between 15,000 and 20,000 inhabitants. So all of a sudden, the population tripled in a week time. The sad part is that we have now more internally displaced people and refugees than in August 2014, which was the peak of the crisis. We have also a kind of pendular displacement. For example, people who are fleeing to DRC, whenever the situation is getting a bit better, they are coming back. And sometimes they are just coming back actually to get the humanitarian assistance and go back to look for security. The armed groups' modus operandi is really conducive to this kind of displacement. For me, it's really spreading the terror among the communities and making sure that they cannot have a single day where they feel comfortable. We started to prepare the ground for them to return to their villages of origin. And whenever we have been very close to do it, immediately the armed groups came to prevent them from going back to their homes. As long as people are within a camp, with no perspective, with no alternative, children are going to school, this is not going to help support and strengthen the reconciliation, because every day you have a good reason to be angry. While if you are given a chance to go back to a normal life, to send your kids to school, to have access to health without discrimination, and you are not prevented from accessing a hospital just because you are from an ethnic or you are from a specific religion, as long as this is not happening, and a critical mass of those IDPs and those refugees going back to their life, peace is still threatened.
Insecurity and recurrent displacement has led to a steep decline in crop production and an increase in food prices and malnutrition. Can you talk about that?
When the displaced left their villages, they left also their fields. In many places, security is not good enough for them to go back to work their field and go back to the camp, which had a dramatic drop in the crop production. We have seen that, for example, for those who fled Tupawa, displaced Tupawa because of the latest upsurge of violence. What they are trying to do now is to go during the day with the security of MINUSCA to still try to go back there to work their field so they don't completely lose the year. And this is the time where they have to work their field. This is definitely impacting the food prices, but also their capacity to cope with the crisis. The humanitarian assistance in Central Africa Republic is really underfunded. And sadly, until now, when we are already the first quarter, it's only 1% funded. So with that, we come up as humanitarian with some very tough decision to cut by half, for example, the ration we are providing the population with. You have people in front of you who are starving. And every single time I go to the field, it's so terrible. But at the same time, we have no choice. Without the funding, we won't be able really to do much more than that.
You wear many hats in the CIR. You are the Deputy Special Representative for MINUSCA, the UNDP's resident representative, as well as the UN resident coordinator, the humanitarian coordinator. How do you keep on task?
There is a reason why the so-called triple hat was created. It is sometimes difficult, and sometimes there are competing priorities. First of all, for each hat, I have great teams in the field. And in Bangui, not a single person would be able to do it alone. So I'm very grateful to the teams and to the colleagues who actually are there every day to help me up to my responsibility. Being a MINUSCA, DSRHD, and humanitarian coordinator comes with a lot of drama because humanitarian coordinator, seeing every day with military, with uniformed people, that's an issue. And it will remain an issue. But at the same time, being both helped us come up with a very good civil-military coordination, because obviously I am sitting on both sides. So it's much easier just to pick up the phone, call the force commander and tell him, well, you know, my NGO there, we need you actually to intervene immediately and to send a battalion because there is a situation there. Well, if I was only the humanitarian coordinator, that will be, hello, madam, thank you, when noted. I mean, being the DSRHD, action is taken. So yes, there are some limits. It's very important for me to make sure wherever I go, to make it very clear which hat I'm wearing. Whenever I go to the field, and I go to the field every week. As humanitarian coordinator, I don't do the military honor because the military honor is more for the DSRSG. So then I tell them, well, no, today I am just the third person. It is important that also in our statements and our dealing with the national authorities or even with the armed groups, when I am negotiating access, also to specify what is the quality I am using to address them. It's definitely a schizophrenic position, but at the same time, I could really see how integration is very important. And because I have also the hat of the resident coordinator, I'm able to bring all UN agencies together with the humanitarian to really walk the talk when it comes to humanitarian and development nexus. And obviously to also tap into the capacity and the expertise of UNDP to boost in some areas where the security allows it very good recovery programs.
Can you give a reason why there should be more women in field operation?
There are a lot of women who are really victims of the conflict. And they have been through a lot of suffering and horrible things, including sexual violence, but not only that. Whenever I go to the field and wherever I am, I create a space for those women to express and voice all what they have been through. In doing so, get their buy-in so they become the agents of peace and they become the agents of reconciliation. This is what a woman leader can bring to the table. Having women leaders is giving us much more legitimacy, definitely much more credibility.
Najat Rochdi on the multiple challenges she and the UN mission's troops and staff in the Central African Republic face on a daily basis, doing their best to walk the talk despite the threats posed by armed groups. That's it for this edition of our UN and Africa podcast from UN News. Just a reminder that we're part of a new multimedia website platform these days at news.un.org. You'll find all our audio bulletins, features, interviews and podcasts by clicking on the Audio Hub logo in the top right-hand corner. There's plenty of rich UN-related text and video content available there too, covering Africa and everywhere else on the planet. We'll be back later in the month. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks so much for listening. This is Africa Morning. Fangabe.